This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Greens charge the Democrats with stealing them blind in a special election in Philadelphia. Black self-determination is an election issue in St. Petersburg, Florida, and a lesson on how to denounce and shame sellout black politicians. But first, there seems to be no end to the anti-Russian hysteria that Democrats have been spreading since they lost the election in November. We spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, who's written extensively on the McCarthyism of an earlier era. Dr. Horn calls the current scare campaign the Putin derangement syndrome.
Certainly, the hypocrisy and sanctimony in Washington is breathtaking. Keep in mind that as recently as 1996, you had U.S. consultants standing shoulder to shoulder with Russian President Boris Yeltsin as he shelled his parliament. And the Yankees, of course, cheered. And so for Washington now to object to alleged Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election is hypocrisy of the rankest sort. In any case, we all know the United States buys politicians all the time. The Shah of Iran is one of many foreign leaders who was on the U.S. payroll. We recall how the United States interfered blatantly in the elections in Italy in 1947, up to and including recruiting Italian Americans to write their relatives in Italy. We recall how the United States has killed foreign leaders, including Patrice Lumumba of the Congo in the early 1960s, and sponsored coups such as in Chile in 1973. The list is endless. So what Washington should be talking about, assuming there is a shred of evidence to their claims, is chickens coming home to roost. In any case, if you begin to examine some of the so-called evidence in this case, it quickly falls apart. I mean, look at CrowdStrike. This is the private firm that came forward with the allegation in the summer of 2016 that Russia supposedly had hacked into the emails of Senator Clinton's campaign leader, John Podesta. But recently, in both Counterpunch and in BuzzFeed, serious claims, serious contentions have been raised with regard to the competence of CrowdStrike. This, of course, is not broken through into the pages of the New York Times. Instead, in the New York Times, just about 9 or 10 days ago, you saw how they turned over this valuable piece of journalistic real estate, speaking of the op-ed page, to one Louise Minch, who, of course, is a neocon loon with close ties to Rupert Murdoch, who the New York Times sees virtually as public enemy number one, given the competition between the New York Times and Murdoch's Wall Street Journal. In any case, Louise Minch gave so-called guidance to members of Congress who were going to be questioning FBI Director James Comey that following Monday. But what they did not mention, what the New York Times did not mention about Louise Minch, is that she is the source for the ridiculous claim that Anthony Weiner, the estranged spouse of Huma Abedin, the leader, a leader of Senator Clinton's campaign in 2016, that Anthony Weiner, the notorious Anthony Weiner, who was caught texting with a teenager, Louise Minch says that the teenager was actually an agent of Vladimir Putin. Likewise, when Andrew Breitbart, the late founder of Breitbart News, turned up dead a few years ago, it was Louise Minch who said that he was actually a victim of Vladimir Putin, Putin's agents. I mean, it seems that a kind of Putin derangement syndrome has spread from Washington to New York. And in any case, if you look at the New York Times' own pages, for example, look at their coverage of the latest WikiLeaks revelations, where in the body of the story, it was noted that the CIA has the ability to leave digital fingerprints in a hack that the CIA conducts that would lead the unsuspecting to think it's the hack of another party. For example, there could be a hack of the Democratic National Committee with digital fingerprints of Moscow, but actually it could be executed by another force or another source. I think that this turmoil about Russia represents a kind of turmoil in the upper ranks of the U.S. ruling elite about Moscow and the declining position of U.S. imperialism given the rise of China. For example, if you look on the website of Foreign Affairs, the elite journal published by the Council on Foreign Relations, you'll find an article by Robert English of University of Southern California, former Bernie Sanders advisor, who upbraids implicitly Foreign Affairs itself and the U.S. ruling elite as a whole for its one-sided approach to Russia, including the expansion of NATO to the borders of Russia, which is a provocation, to put it mildly. This anti-Russia position, it seems to me, is reaching exhaustion, and even without the rise of Donald Trump and his supposed overtures to Moscow, it would be long past time for a serious and agonizing reappraisal of U.S. policy towards Moscow. I mean, for example, I think that there are those who are fantasizing in Washington that Cold War II will end up like Cold War I, that is to say, with Vladimir Putin crying uncle. But if you look at the international situation, you'll find that Japan has very good relations with Russia. Of course, they want the Kuril Islands back that Russia claimed after, or the Soviet Union claimed after World War II. You may recall that during the Sochi Olympics, the Japanese delegation headed by Prime Minister Abe actually stayed for quite a long time. China has good relations with Russia. In fact, according to China Daily, there will be at least five meetings this year alone between Putin and President Xi. I know couples who don't meet five times a year. India historically has had good relations with Russia. That continues. Whoever wins the French election, it seems to me, will be forced to pursue that policy. And as well, you might have noticed the frosty reception accorded Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, when she visited Washington. This may force Germany to drop its hard line towards Russia, a policy, by the way, egged on by the United States of America. And in any case, with the impending British exit from the European Union, there's already talk about a U.S.-UK alliance with the European Union, France and Germany, being in the crosshairs. I think that helps to shed light on the frosty reception given Angela Merkel. If that takes place, Angela Merkel will be forced to embrace Moscow. Now, the Democrats, instead of pursuing a realistic analysis of the 2016 victory that might, for example, focus on black voter suppression as a key to that loss, particularly in urban centers like Milwaukee, like John Kerry in 2004, who thought that he could play up his military credentials and went over the so-called centrist white vote. Instead, he was, of course, swift voted. You see that the Democrats feel that they can win over these so-called centrist whites by playing the anti-Moscow card, given the deep and pervasive and profound anti-Moscow sentiment that in some ways has leaked into the post-Cold War era. It seems to me that the Democrats would be better advised to pursue a different course. But in any case, what the Democrats and those who are backing them fail to acknowledge is that the height of hypocrisy involves calling for a kind of free trade when it comes to political campaigning abroad, such as putting the Shah of Iran on your payroll, but protectionism at home. That is to say, no so-called foreign interference in U.S. elections. That position simply cannot stand, and it will not stand. And in any case, if you look beyond Trump, look at Henry Kissinger, for example, who engineered the opening to China, and that, of course, has helped to put Washington in a deep hole, another posture and position that the ruling elite analysts fail to acknowledge. But Henry Kissinger engineered this opening to China. Then when he left office, he set up Kissinger Associates, which then began to open doors for U.S. transnational corporations to invest in China, and then wrote a book called On China, which is obsequious and idolatrous in its view, not only of China, but the Chinese Communist Party. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if it were used in the higher party school in Beijing. And that's the kind of ongoing scandal that is routinely ignored in Washington and in New York, while on the other hand, you see the U.S. Senate today go down the rabbit hole with regard to trying to ferret out alleged Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election.
One could look at the attempts to stir up panic and crisis behind this alleged Russian threat as being as much symptomatic of a panic and crisis among the rulers in the United States. What are they panicked and so afraid about?
Well, number one, China's on the passing lane. The late Nobel laureate Robert Fogel of the University of Chicago suggested that within decades, not only would the Chinese economy be larger than that of the United States, it could be twice as large as that of the United States. At the same time, as noted, Russia has improved its international position as well. And then, of course, I think that there's understandable and justifiable panic about this nincompoop who's occupying the Oval Office, who is totally unqualified, does not even know what he doesn't know, and he is going to be possibly the Gorbachev of the United States, that is to say, selected by a certain sector of the electorate to save the system, but will unwittingly help to wreck the system. I think that these U.S. elite analysts would be better advised to do, once again, an agonizing reappraisal of policy over the past few decades and come to the rather painful conclusion that it was the Cold War that helped to create the conditions that led to the rise of Donald Trump. That is to say, it was not only this ideological conflict with Moscow and socialism, it involved the attempt to weaken and erode the influence of unions at home, which has helped to drive down the wages and working conditions of the working class. At the same time, under international pressure, the United States was forced to move away from its apartheid policies of Jim Crow. This has led demagogues, in particular, to suggest that the U.S. ruling elite cares more about black people than it does about the working class. And, of course, we are not part of the working class, so they mean the white working class. I mean, this is ludicrous. This is the looniest idea since Looney Tunes. But this is the kind of nonsense that passes for analysis. You might have seen the article in the New York Times op-ed page right after the election by the Columbia University professor, whose name will not pass my lips, who suggested that the problem in the United States is so-called identity politics. That is to say, paying too much attention to Black Lives Matter and not paying attention to so-called white identity politics, which is, of course, ludicrous and ridiculous. But once again, this is what passes for analysis. In any case, it also helps to obscure the point that the most pervasive identity politics, if you're going to use that term, in the history of this country has been the construction of whiteness. That is to say, this artificial identity that helped to meld together disparate European ethnic groups who are warring on the shores of Europe, English versus Irish, English versus Scottish, French versus German, Russian versus Pole, Serb versus Croat, when they cross the Atlantic, magically they're transmuted into white, which of course is an organizing principle whereby you can dispossess the Native Americans and enslave the Africans. That, of course, is not viewed as identity politics. The problem is that kind of identity politics, in a sense, has hit the wall, not least because of a changed international situation, but rather than confront that ugly reality and use that as a springboard to analyze how and why Donald J. Trump got elected, instead you have these puerile analyses by so-called Ivy League professors that basically amount to little more than throwing dust in the eyes of the public.
You spoke of how black voter suppression played a measurable role in the Democratic defeat as opposed to the immeasurable role that the Russians may have played. But the entirety of the Congressional Black Caucus now talks Russian threat all day, and doesn't talk about black voter suppression.
I was very disappointed when I watched the hearings involving FBI Director James Comey to witness the examination of Mr. Comey by Congressman Andre Carson of Indiana, one of the few Muslims in the ranks of the House of Representatives. I expected him somehow, hoping against hope, that he would take a different tack. But he, too, took this prosecutorial approach towards Moscow. The same was true of CBC member Congresswoman Sewell of Alabama, whose constituents are suffering tremendously. And I'm not sure what her constituents gain from going down the rabbit hole in pursuit of this Russian non-story.
Well, I suppose it has something to do with solidarity with the party rather than with the folks.
Well, possibly. Now, I should say that the problem I have with the investigation is not the investigation per se, because I'm all in with regard to driving Donald J. Trump out of office by any means necessary, even if it winds up leaving Michael Pence as the chief executive, because if that happens, the Republicans will be so weakened that it will be difficult for them to move forward. The problem is that the agenda of the Democrats is more than just weakening Trump. They want to launch a new Cold War against Russia, and that is very dangerous. That is very ominous. It bespeaks spending more on the military, which is going to be taking milk from the mouths of babes, figuratively, if not literally. And that's the danger with this Russian tack. And I would hope sooner rather than later the CBC would wake up to this very obvious reality.
Does it not bother you that an ouster of Trump at the hands of forces that involve deeply the CIA and what some folks call the deep state would be a Pyrrhic kind of victory for those who want to get rid of Trump?
Well, not necessarily. It's just, for example, the healthcare debacle of less than a week ago. That healthcare debacle weakened the Trump forces tremendously. It weakened the Republican Party tremendously. And I think that that is good news because it means that they'll have difficulty in pursuing their policy of cutting taxes further for the wealthy. Likewise, I think that ousting Trump, even though he will be ousted perhaps by means that are specious, would be a step forward because it would weaken the Republicans. And if you step outside of the United States for a second, I think it's fair to say that if the U.S. ruling elite is in turmoil, and that would be the news if Trump is ousted, then that's good news for international peace and security because, like any class, the U.S. ruling class finds it difficult to move forward when it's not united. That is to say, when they're at each other's throats, such as when you see this de facto civil war that's unfolding in the Republican Party of the United States, it becomes very difficult for them to accomplish anything. And right now, since most of the things that the U.S. ruling elite wants to accomplish abroad have a malevolent intention and purpose, well, driving them into turmoil, it seems to me, is good news.
And finally, you seem to be saying that the United States and its Russia baiting, its incessant pressures against Russia, might have the effect of isolating not Moscow, but the United States as the U.S. isolated itself in trying to isolate Cuba.
Precisely. That was the import of my remark, that those who are fantasizing that Cold War II would end up like Cold War I are basically, they're on opium. I mean, they've been smoking their drapes. I think that the way the world stands right now in terms of the correlation of forces is that the attempt to isolate Moscow, particularly given the unpopularity of Donald J. Trump, who after all is still president, whether or not that is the policy he pursues or not, is going to further weaken the credibility of the United States, further weaken the so-called soft power of the United States. Already you see this with regard to these moves by Trump to move away from the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Objectively, that's going to drive other countries, even Australia, which has basically been a toady of Uncle Sam for decades, but now faces dramatic evidence of the impact of climate change in terms of this rising temperatures, in terms of other factors that are influencing its environment. It too is being driven into the arms of Beijing. So I think that this anti-Moscow policy, which on the other hand is understandable given the rather psychotic anti-Russian Russophobia that exists in the U.S. ruling class, it's understandable, but right now it's worse than dysfunctional.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking from Houston. The Pennsylvania Green Party thought they had an excellent chance to win a special election for a state legislative seat from the Kensington section of Philadelphia last week. But the Greens say the Philadelphia Democratic machinery blatantly stole the election in broad daylight. Sherry Honkola, the Green Party candidate, has been an activist in Kensington for decades. Both she and her Democratic opponent, Emilio Vazquez, were write-in candidates. Honkola, the Green, because officials rejected her voter signature petitions, and Vazquez because the original Democratic candidate was charged with corruption. Hardly anybody in Kensington votes for Republicans. But despite the Greens running a vigorous campaign with lots of boots on the ground, the Democrat was awarded the election by a huge margin of votes. Honkola says it's a fraud and a crime.
This special election has been an absolute nightmare. They basically carbon copied the same amount of votes from the last time that the state rep was in office here, Leslie Acosta. So I think that they just panicked and got real sloppy. You know, they control all the tables. They control all the machines. They pretty much control the courts and all the city offices. So this was pretty much an inside job.
What do you mean they carbon copied?
Well, we had folks doing tallies outside the doors on election day, and the count in no way matched what the official election results were. And we have about four or five different videos of the passing of money from judges to Emilio workers on his campaign on the day of election. We have a photograph of the actual secret voting box at Emilio's victory party the evening of the election. And there's also another video with like three different people in one voting booth. There's just dozens of reports from all over from different people. And some of the voter fraud reports are from Democrats themselves. They're also from Republicans, and they're also from the Greens.
So you're charging fraud. How are you going to pursue this?
Well, we have a wonderful attorney. His name is Sam Stretton, and another wonderful attorney, Michael Cord. Michael Cord specializes in as a civil rights attorney, and Sam Stretton is the best election lawyer in town. So we're going to go to federal court. We're not going to state court or handling things on a local level because we have other problems right now in Philadelphia. Our district attorney is out on bail right now. He's been indicted with 24 counts of fraud himself. It just seems like there's a lot of Democrats here that get lost in the greed and start to pad their bank accounts with lots of money. And I know that Seth, who's our DA, one of the things was that he was charging different drug dealers that were in jail different rates of money in order to get out. It's a difficult thing because on election day, we couldn't really call Seth Williams because he himself in court that day. So we had to call the assistant DAs who were all, you know, really focused on what was happening to him. So it was hard to get justice in a town when the head guy is probably on his way to jail as well.
When the tallies were in, the count was quite lopsided. Have you ever seen anything like this in your experience in Philadelphia politics?
No. I mean, we had the ground game. Emilio came onto the ballot like 3 weeks before the end of the election. Nobody knew who the parking authority guy was. Our folks had knocked every door in the district 3-4 times over. We had a great ground game. We had people at all of the polls, posters throughout the entire community. Everybody knows about me and my work for like the last 30 years. And we just literally sat there in shock.
Well, this must cast a pall over the Green Party's entire effort in Philadelphia if it's going to turn out like this every time you guys go to the polls.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. And, you know, the amount of young people that worked on my campaign and the fact that I live and work in a frontline community, young people were really excited about engaging in politics again. And they were just devastated to see the fist fights that were breaking out in front of voting booths and people being snuck in back doors. And when people went in to go vote, they had Emilio's stamps on his table inside the voting booth, which is against the law. So it was a devastating thing for many people to go through, not to mention over 2,000 people contributed financially to my campaign of increments of $20 to $40.
And what's the Philadelphia media have to say about this flawed election?
The Philadelphia media has pretty much acted, I mean, they're beginning now to cover some of the fraud, but by and large, it's a total whiteout. It's as if this thing didn't even happen. This district, my district, is familiar with being made invisible. We're desperately trying to talk to as many folks from progressive media as possible because this is one of the first special elections after the horrible guy Trump was elected, and now we're living under the Trump era. And I think that my campaign was an example of how we begin to get organized and take back our communities. Yes, they stole the election, but this is as local as you can possibly get. And these are all impoverished folks from my neighborhood that have decided that we're going to battle away. And if it means taking this thing to federal court, if it means holding the marches, doing the demonstrations, doing whatever we possibly can, we just cannot go on with this legacy of corruption and absolute neglect. My district is the poorest district in Pennsylvania.
You say this is the Trump era, but it's the Democrats that you charge stole the election from you.
Yeah, now isn't that interesting? Yeah, it's the Trump era, and, you know, the same thing, right? I mean, people are basically saying that the Democrats, like they did to Bernie, they definitely did to me in this district, where they went after additional resources and used a propaganda campaign to say that the district was going to be taken over by Republicans when they knew damn well that this district would never go to a Republican, has never gone to a Republican. They put out there in the community, they took a photograph and put it on the back of Emilio's flyers and basically called me a Republican. You know, they basically said, don't let the neighborhood be taken over by outsiders and Republicans. And then they had a picture of Trump, the Republican, and myself on the back.
So yeah. You're saying that they used a combination of scare the folks with Trump tactics and outright fraud.
That's correct. Total misinformation. Because everybody that knows me was then like, what? How can they say that you're Republican? They're saying you're Republican. That was rough, and they didn't spring that particular flyer until the day of the election. And that was their main source of lit, is passing out at all the polls that I was a Republican.
Sherry Honkola says the Green Party is demanding a new election in the Kensington, Philadelphia district. In St. Petersburg, Florida, 20-year-old Aretha Akile Kenyon is running for the city council on a platform of black self-determination. She's putting into practice some of the 19 points of the Black is Back Coalition's National Black Agenda for Self-Determination. The coalition this weekend holds a two-day electoral political school in St. Petersburg to help train a new breed of black political activists and candidates. City Council candidate Kenyon explains the message that she brings to her campaign. That was Aretha Akile Kenyon in St. Petersburg, Florida. Black community activists in New York City recently disrupted a speech that Bronx City Councilman Andy King was trying to give before an audience at the Schomburg Center for Research on Black Culture in Harlem. Shannon Jones is a co-founder of the organization Why Accountability, which is working in solidarity with the 120 young men swept up in a huge police raid of a public housing project in the Bronx. Andy King is the councilman for that district, but rather than come to the aid of his constituents, King cozied up to the cops. And then King went to the Schomburg Center, according to Shannon Jones, and tried to pose as a criminal justice system reformer. In an interview with Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier, Jones explained why Councilman King needed to be shamed and made accountable to the people of Harlem and the Bronx.
And able to have a social life, and that's something that the city funds and supports so that black families can be elevated and be able to experience life just as, you know, people in the white community get to experience life. And that black people don't have to worry about not being able to go to work because they don't have anywhere to bring their kids, and that they don't have to drop their kids off at some unaffordable child care service that becomes like a whole nother monthly bill type situation. So those are just a couple of different things that were really taken from the 19-point platform of the National Black Political Agenda.
Clearly, you don't think the police in St. Petersburg, Florida are accountable to the black community right now.
Most definitely not. And speaking in terms of that, the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, they murdered three black teenage girls last year on March 31st, and actually today marks the one-year anniversary of the murder of Dominique Battle, Lanai Miller, and Ashanti Butler. And these deputies violated their own laws, their own codes, and chased these girls, corralled these girls, and led them to a dead-end pond, and then watched them drown and didn't do anything about it. And the head sheriff, he makes up this lie. He wages a slander campaign so that he can cover up the murder of these girls, so that he can defend his deputies and justify why three teenage black girls had to be murdered that night. And there is no accountability to the black community. Every time a black person is killed here in the city, there has been no accountability. No police officer, no sheriff's deputy has ever been arrested or indicted with criminal charges for the murder of black people in our community. So, no, they're not accountable to the black community, but they will be.
And what was the response of the person who now holds the seat in the city council that you're seeking to the death of these three young black women?
Carl Nurse. He is the current District 6 city councilman. He's a white man over what used to be a predominantly black district, but due to gentrification, that is no longer the case. Carl Nurse and even the mayor, Rick Kreisman, they did not make a public statement about three black teenage girls and citizens of St. Pete. They didn't make a statement. They didn't say anything about the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department. They didn't say anything about this murder. And when the black community criticized them for not saying anything, they then said that they have no jurisdiction over the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, and that's an issue that, you know, they can't deal with. And we know that that's not true. And we had a former police chief here in St. Pete named Goliath Davis who removed the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department from our community. And it was an eight-year span where no black people in the city were murdered by police because of that ban of the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department. So, you know, they have all the ability to hold the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department responsible and accountable for the murder of these three black teenage girls, and they didn't. They didn't say anything.
So what's been the response of the people out there in the streets when you present this kind of platform?
The response has been great, like really positive, and the people are ready for this type of platform and are excited that somebody has come forth with a plan that actually speaks to, you know, what this community needs. And when I go into the community and I see the devastation, every point of the platform, there's somebody that can relate to it, you know, more and more. And going out to the community to talk about gentrification, and there is people who are going through that process right now, who have lost their homes, who can't afford their homes anymore, who are struggling looking for a place to stay now, and see the fact that there's no affordable housing, and they see all these white people come into their communities and living in their communities, and they can't even get their own house. And then you see, you know, black people in the city with no, you know, means to feed, clothe, or house themselves. And they're really pushing for some real genuine economic development. And they're sick and tired of, you know, the same old politicians. They hate the politicians that are currently in place. And they want them removed. And they want somebody to actually say what it is that we need, which is essentially what I'm doing. And I'm not afraid to do. And that's another thing that really gets them excited about this campaign, because of the fact that there's no filter on what it is that the black community needs and what I'm putting forth. There is no compromise in the line of what the black community needs, despite its pushback from the politicians currently in power, or even people who aren't in the community, the petty bourgeoisie, the sellouts of this community, or even the affected of the white community, who can't align themselves with self-determination for the black community. There is no compromise of this line for them. And the people are really happy to see somebody defending them at all costs and putting together a platform that speaks to what it is that we need in our community.
You don't have much money, and you're going up against folks who do. How can you get people power to propel this campaign?
We are looking for support from anyone, and we understand that this campaign and me winning the city council seat in St. Pete is going to affect, it's going to affect the political momentum around this entire country. And how people can get involved in this social movement is to visit aqafordistrictnumber6.com. We need, again, you said we're going against big money politicians, and that's the truth. And we need the people to really propel this movement forward. And you can visit that website. You can donate. You can join the committee from wherever you are, because there's a position for you no matter where you are. We want to make this a national campaign. So if you want to work on the team of, you know, social media, outreach, or, you know, whatever the case may be, visit aqafordistrictnumber6.com and get involved in this campaign, this social movement for radical times, radical solutions, and a new beginning for Southside St. Pete.
That was Aretha Akile Kenyon in St. Petersburg, Florida. Black community activists in New York City recently disrupted a speech that Bronx City Councilman Andy King was trying to give before an audience at the Schomburg Center for Research on Black Culture in Harlem. Shannon Jones is a co-founder of the organization Why Accountability, which is working in solidarity with the 120 young men swept up in a huge police raid of a public housing project in the Bronx. Andy King is the councilman for that district, but rather than come to the aid of his constituents, King cozied up to the cops. And then King went to the Schomburg Center, according to Shannon Jones, and tried to pose as a criminal justice system reformer. In an interview with Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier, Jones explained why Councilman King needed to be shamed and made accountable to the people of Harlem and the Bronx.
When the raids happened, it was billed as the largest gang raid in New York City history. Prior to that, the largest raid was Manhattanville Grant 101, and East Chester Gardens and the immediate surrounding community was 120 guys, 78 of them on the street, and I believe another 30-something were already incarcerated on other charges, whether they were related or unrelated to the indictment that involved the raid. So in late April, a host of federal, city, and state law enforcement agencies conducted this raid of the East Chester Garden community, and they pulled out men that were part of a supposed, alleged RICO conspiracy. So the numbers alone top that of the Manhattanville grant. So how that has to do with Andy King is that that's within his community district. So obviously, community residents are looking for some type of assistance, whether that be legal, whether that be media support, emotional support, understanding what is in front of them. And Andy King really was hands-off. I remember very clearly going to East Chester Gardens right after the raid happened as a community activist with Y Accountability and also on a personal level as a NYCHA resident. Andy King sent a representative that really wasn't clear on the events and circumstances, and the community was not allowed to use the center in order to meet and collaborate to plan how they would respond to this event. And then just a few days later, his office got together with police and had a community meeting. So that was very unfortunate, because what that did was just reiterate and reinforce the police presence in the East Chester Garden community. After that, Andy King held an anti-gang meeting in his community district office, where he proceeded to tell the community how to spot if your child is in gangs. And he did this in collaboration with NYPD Community Affairs. That's a no-no to the community. You cannot have that type of relationship and still expect the community to trust you, because you're essentially, the new term people use is called docs, where you're being documented as fill in the blank, whatever that may be, usually negatively. And Andy King's office is essentially aiding in that. So the family members felt betrayed. They were still without answers. And if it wasn't for community activist groups, such as Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, Cop Watch Patrol Unit, and Take Back the Bronx, these families would have absolutely no support whatsoever. If one is holding an elected office, you're beholden to the community members, the people that live in East Chester Garden. And that's a relationship that you have to properly balance. And Andy King has effectively demonstrated that he's out of balance with the community. Because if the East Chester Gardens parents, family members, community members, and NYCHA residents needed to have a rapid response meeting and were not even able to access a space in order to do that, but then he pulled together a meeting with police, you know, this is the type of damage control formula that the NYPD is engaging in. They come into a community and stratify them through police oppression and state-sanctioned violence and gang tactics, and then try to meet with the community to fluff it up. So this was done with East Chester Gardens and most recently done with the Kingsborough 7. So they're able to continue to indoctrinate the community that this type of behavior is okay, and these are just the criminals that we have to get rid of. When that really isn't the case, RICO is for criminal enterprise. You can't be criminal enterprise if you're sleeping on your mother's couch, if you're hiding from NYCHA in your mother's apartment when you've already been excluded, if you have a job at Home Depot when you ride the train or the bus. Some criminal enterprise for these guys allegedly in East Chester Gardens. So we expect our elected officials to offer support to families, even families where the situation is not so nice and tidy, what I like to call respectability politics. Andy King plays a lot of respectability politics that we find as grassroots activists totally problematic. So if you could make a mental picture, Andy King, city councilman of the community district 12, where law enforcement forcibly extricated 78 men from the East Chester Gardens NYCHA housing development, for which they are now incarcerated, where the 13th Amendment allows them to perform involuntary servitude by virtue of being a convict. Then you come to Schaumburg and attempt to explain to the Harlem community why that's a problem. It's hypocrisy. those folks in that environment may not have been aware of Andy King's behaviors in his own community district.
Could you talk a little bit about the aspect of social media and other kinds of digital surveillance with respect to these so-called gang crackdowns?
Okay, well, actually, it's twofold. The social media piece is through NYPD surveillance of social media activity of these young people. I regularly attend my PSA 7 Precinct Community Council meeting, and it was openly stated that they have 24/7 police surveillance on social media activity of young people. So that's one way to get quote unquote doxxed based on who your friends list is, certain social media posts that you like, things that you may post. There are guys that have put up rap lyrics and have been doxxed to be gang members. So then the other side of this that is outside of social media, the NYPD and other law enforcement agencies are doxing you in your environment, whether you even touch social media at all. I can go to a particular bodega. I can walk a certain way across the street. I can have certain clothes on. If I have a certain number of interactions with someone else that has been doxxed to be a gang member, now I'm doxxed as a gang member. And the important piece to all of that is there's no vetting of whether that assessment is actually factual. So if you think about it, if the NYPD decides to say that me, Shannon Jones, I am a gang member, there's no vetting process for the community, for other members of law enforcement, for the courts to say, no, I'm not in a gang. Or even better still, I'm in a gang. What does that mean? Law enforcement doesn't even have to define what a gang is, how a gang functions, and how being in a quote-unquote gang is harmful to the community. They don't even have to meet a standard. They just have to document that you're in a gang, and that's the long and short of it. So the standard, the bar is set so low at the detriment of our young people in the community.
Does that not create essentially a catch-22 for those who live in a community that is being targeted with this kind of surveillance?
Everybody knows at this point, it's been exposed, that these raids or these gang raids are a larger enterprise to sanitize communities that are prime for gentrification. Because if it was a matter of going to a particular store, wearing a certain article of clothing, I'm in a gang. If that's the criteria, there's 75-year-old women that should be in the gang as far as the criteria is concerned. So how is it that these are young men under age 30 that are being doxxed in a gang? I've never had a problem with the police when I wear red or I wear purple or I wear green. Why is this a problem for young black men or young Latino men? And I ask those questions rhetorically, because there has to be some type of paper trail to justify the body snatching. This doesn't happen in Garrison Beach. It just doesn't. And as much as black culture or quote-unquote hip-hop culture has spread worldwide, I know full well those white boys in Garrison Beach are wearing jerseys, fitted caps, snapback caps, do-rags, Timberlands with the laces open, giving themselves hand gestures when they greet each other, but they're not being doxxed as gang members.
Why are these gang raids going on throughout the city so significant?
We have to remember, this country is built on all levels of propaganda, from very simple hamburger commercials to what's in our school textbooks. And the propaganda that's being pushed is that high crime still exists in NYCHA. The highest levels of crime in the city are concentrated in NYCHA developments. And we've had the lowest crime rates in decades at this point. So whatever crime rates exist in NYCHA are far, far lower than citywide crime rates 10 years ago, 15 years ago, in 1995 when we had a crack era. But if we can isolate NYCHA as being a detriment to the community, a powder keg to the community, then that will build sentiment towards redesigning NYCHA, whether that means change the composition of its residents, whether that be economically or racially, or completely absolving the governmental authority from running the development, whether that be on the city-state level or even on the HUD level, because as you see, HUD under Ben Carson and Donald Trump are beginning to defund NYCHA. So the reason why gang raids are relevant in that effort is to solidify that propaganda that there are people in NYCHA that make it a horrible place for others to live. And if you read that in the newspaper, you see it in a soundbite when you wake up in the morning, then a governmental authority comes along and says, well, we're going to begin to privatize. It's easy for John Q. Public to say, yeah, that needs to be completely gutted because they are just havens for gangs and crime, when that is actually not the case. Those are alternative facts.
Would you liken this process to this push of rendering or defining public schools as failing only to bring in privatization or charterization efforts?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that is the whole underpinning of the Trump administration. And I say Trump administration not to absolve our city and state actors of responsibility in this process, because let's remember, long before Trump came into office, you had Democrats, liberals, or even those that would brand themselves as progressive performing these policies against our people. But that notwithstanding, if we're looking at it on the federal level, it appears as though the federal government is seeking to undo all of the strides that were made for the advancement of Black people. So when you talk about access to public housing, remember before public housing was built across this country, Black people were stratified in slum ghettos. Blacks were excluded from the Homestead Act, from the GI Bill, from the Veteran Administration. So when public housing was built, that was a relief and a reprieve for Black people to have stable housing that they could afford. So now we're at a place, fast forward 60 years, 65 years, where we're undermining those institutions. So public housing is one and public education is another. This is really about how can we destabilize Black progress in this country.
In your view, what is the next step with respect to resistance against the onslaught of raids and especially so-called gang raids throughout the communities of New York City?
Knowledge is power, first and foremost. The community has to pull this out of the shadows and not be embarrassed if it's your child that got pulled out. Because when we openly talk about it, now we can engage in self-defense. Because that's the difference between a politician or progressive politician or a phony liberal and hardcore militant grassroots activists. The former will have you spinning in conversation, endless town halls, endless panels. No, the militant grassroots community activists will talk about it in order to defend ourselves. So the community has to be proactive in self-defense. And that means, one, informing the community or informing ourselves that there is a phenomenon taking place. What that phenomenon is and what that means for you and your family. because some people feel, well, my child doesn't sell drugs. He doesn't hang out with gang members. This can't happen to me. No, it can happen to you because the police have pulled up pictures of your kid still in middle school with these people they want to extricate out of the community. So it can happen to you. It can happen to all of us at any time. So when we bring that information up, now we can defend ourselves. Same way Black people had to create a green book. The green book was a guide to how you could travel cross country without getting lynched. How you can go to different hotels or restaurants or lodging that would be favorable to Blacks and which route you had to take in order not to end up beaten or murdered by white supremacists. This is what we have to go back to. So now we have to educate a whole two generations, but I wouldn't even say one, how to conduct yourself in self-defense mode on social media. Then the community members, the elders, must also affirmatively demand from these governmental authorities that this behavior stops. Anytime you have elders or community members saying, not all cops, I don't like crime, I don't like gangs, that defers our liberation, it defers our progress, it impedes our self-defense, right? Also, I say NYCHA is the sleeping giant. You got 500,000 people in these buildings. God knows how many more are living in the buildings that are not on the lease. This is the sleeping giant. That will definitely put a rest to faulty repairs, this phony public-private partnership, which really means in English private-private partnership, and a return to slum-level segregation of Blacks in this country, you know, and all points in between. So I guess, in a word, I would say self-defense, and that goes on many, many fronts. You know, but a lot of it is being honest about our conditions.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.